It begins with the Romans and Ovid's evocation of the creation of the world. Ovid writes in his Metamorphoses, "With hot the cold parts strove, and wet with dry, and soft with hard, and weight with empty void." Crossing cultures, that description might put us in mind of the biblical image of the Lord as a potter forming humans from the clay. Stephen Houston starts with Ovid's Metamorphoses on his way to the Mayans, and he begins our journey in that way, contending that humans are creatures of change. Born helpless, they grow into adulthood and by a grim path with certain conclusion, stoop and creak to the end. The transformation is inescapable, but there is another one too. Along the way, they do and make again. The need to create cannot be disowned. Crafting is in our bones. Humans' modification of the world goes beyond a tweaking of sticks or stones. Compounding takes place. Tools lead to other tools through an incremental diversification that involves yet other humans. The activity soon becomes social. People gather, they debate, disagree, learn, confer once more. Then they do and make. Clearly, humans cannot help it. Their need to make things, to arc from matter to worked material to final product, arises from some urge that is primal. They are not so much Homo sapiens, a wise human, as Homo faber, the walking primate that makes things out of matter. This is not all muscle memory or habitual action and repetition. There is systematic thought, a response to prior example, along with the need to ask two basic questions. What is this thing in front of me? And what, if anything, should I do with it? All that from The Life Within, Classic Maya and the Matter of Permanence by Stephen Houston. Sometimes this thing in front of us is a cup, and we know what we should do with it. Some cups are nicer than others, but we recognize that they're all here for drinking, for the most part. Other things are not always self-evident, and here's where Houston takes us to the Mayan civilization and to their hieroglyphs. Take, for example, a palace tablet from Chiapas in Mexico. We find that there is an example of sculpturally carved full-figure images of gods. Several of them are working hard, straining at tump lines or headbands used to carry heavy burdens. Without fail, those burdens lack figuration. In a few examples, the entire event of transporting a load echoes the action of dedicating a monument. So, all these suggestions, the clay, the crafting of cups, the sculptural images, as well as the straining under burdens represented in the Mayan glyphs, all prepare us to meet the work of ceramic artist Skip Sensbach in connection with his exhibition titled Mental Blocks, featuring pieces from his Glyphs series at the Wyoming Valley Art League in Wilkes-Barre now through March 30th, with a gallery talk tomorrow evening. Sensbach works in both functional and sculptural ways with clay. He teaches ceramics and is artist in residence at Misericordia University in Dallas, just outside of Wilkes-Barre. He paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about his work and about how he came to clay.
I was always an art fellow from high school onward and went to undergraduate at Keene University in New Jersey. But I was into graphic design, and I was a graphic designer for a while till we moved to Pennsylvania.
And what was the switch?
Honestly, my wife and I saw a flyer. There was a woman, her name was Cindy Pars. She had two wheels in her basement. She'd teach whenever she was in town. We started taking lessons there, fell instantly in love with it, and shortly left graphic design and solely became clay. Not to date myself, but when I went to graphic design, we were still doing things by hand. We were still cutting and pasting and inking and everything. And when I graduated, it was 89, it was right when Apple, I mean, literally that next is when Apple computers took over and everything started to become programming and computers and screens and all you were doing is in the screens. And I was like, that's not what I went to art school for. And then when I put my hands in clay, I was like, wow, this is it. And I liked the fact that they were functional things. At first, that's really what attracted me to the clay, is being able to make bowls and mugs and things that people can use in their everyday life. It's not hanging on a wall. It's not in a space that you can't touch. It's the aspect of the artwork that you interact with every day. Grab that coffee mug in the morning, you eat your cereal and ice cream out of that bowl. You know, that's really what drew me to clay.
What did you investigate? Did you like the strength of stoneware or the delicacy of porcelain or the range?
Stoneware, yeah. I've tried a lot, like did earthenware, didn't really like it. Porcelain and me are not friends. I don't have the patience for it. I really don't. It requires a much finer hand than my hands are. So stoneware seemed to be the perfect clay for me.
And did you, and have you in your museum visits, gone to the ancient Japanese or Chinese sections?
Oh yeah, the Chinese vases and everything. And I think what's really, for me, what's interesting is like we think of the precision of the wheel and everything has to be perfect. At least that's the hurdle that I try to get my students over, because they all come in thinking it has to be perfect. And for instance, you put any one of those vases on a turntable and you spin them, there's a wobble to them. They are not perfect. And which goes into like what is perfection and how much do you really need in your work. And I think the most journeys of potters is perfection, perfection, perfection. You hit it and then you start putting wobbles in your ware because it's boring to have a perfectly round thing.
Did you go through the process of making 50 of the same cups?
Absolutely. That is, you want to know a form, you find a form, you like that form, you do 100 of that form until you know that form inside and out. And you now have it in your catalog of forms, and then you move on to the next form and you do 100 of that form. And, you know, that I think is pretty standard in pottery terms. You know, it's very hard to learn the subtleties of a shape or any form if you're jumping from, I'm going to do this, now I'm going to do this, now I'm going to do this, as opposed to just sitting down and being disciplined to throw the same thing over and over again.
And what about your range then? Did you go from mugs and bowls to plates to vases?
It's usually you start with a form that interests you. I love mugs. I still love mugs. I throw mugs, at least a couple mugs every day. And then you start getting that technical side down, and then you branch into, okay, now I want to do plates. And then you end up doing a lot of plates. And then you go, okay, I want to start fitting lids to jars. And you get into the technical side of getting those lids to actually fit well. And that's kind of the progression. And you just, I always like to tell at least my students and myself, you follow the forms that interest you, because you're not going to want to work on something that really doesn't interest you. So if you're not a cup person or a mug person, then throw bowls. Eventually you'll get around to mugs or cups, but throw what you like.
Having seen your work, you are inspired by the natural world, aren't you?
Yeah, my pottery. I have a pretty broad scope of what inspires me, but my pottery in particular, I guess just from the woods of Pennsylvania, been able to incorporate that. We're talking about the fern pattern. That is my most popular pattern that I have. So I don't think I'll ever be able to stop throwing that, which is okay, because I still enjoy it. You know, that's the nice thing about it. It's like there's never a day. In fact, today, right before here, I was throwing fern stuff. So it's something about taking that leaf and pressing it into the clay and moving the clay around it. It's still enjoyable.
And what about glazes?
Mm-hmm.
Do you mix your own, and have you come up with things that have surprised you, pretty much like a chemist?
It is chemistry. I think that's what astounds people the most when I start talking about glazes, how much chemistry there is involved in it, because it's not a pigment based. So all the colors you're getting and all the things you're getting are chemical reactions with the heat. So yeah, I mix my own glazes. I don't use commercial glazes, but I did when I started. And then you start to get bored with those, and then you start to pick up books and you start to understand the premise of the chemicals and what they do. In fact, right now I'm just starting to understand glaze calculation on a molecular level. And yeah, it's taken me a while to kind of get myself there, but I'm understanding it a little bit more.
And what about the range of firing? Electric, wood, raku?
It all has its specific purpose. You know, electric's great. At the studio at Misericordia, we have an electric kiln, we fire electric, and the glazes tend to come out a little brighter. I have a gas kiln, and in that atmosphere, which is called reduction, you're removing the oxygen from the environment and introducing carbon. So that also changes the clay body and the glazes. And then with Birdie Ceramics, we built a wood kiln up at her studio. And the fact that we fire with wood introduces now ash and carbon and completely changes the wood. And, you know, each one of those firing techniques kind of changes and alters how you make work for that particular kiln. How I throw for the wood kiln is different than how I throw for the gas kiln, because I'm looking to exploit that ash that's in the wood kiln.
We have talked about that process where you all get together as a community of ceramic artists and you take turns feeding the fire, watching the oxygen 24/7, right?
Yeah, it's usually a two-day firing. We start on a Friday morning and we're ending sometime Saturday, depending on how the firing's going. And yeah, there's 6-hour shifts and we have people dedicated to come in every 6 hours. I always get the lucky job of doing the overnight. I'm usually there from 6 to 6 in the next morning, but that's the fun part, you know, stoking that kiln, watching the temperature rise. When it does, you know, when it does rise, it's fun. You hit a couple walls, it gets frustrating, but that's the challenge of it. You know, it's not like a gas kiln. Turn the gas up, turn the gas up, turn the gas up. You'll eventually hit temperature. This, there's a little, you can figure out what mixture of wood you're using, are the dampers open correctly, and adjustments are being made throughout the whole firing. And again, much more community-driven than an electric kiln or a gas kiln, you know. And I think that's been the best part about building that kiln up at Nan's studio, is that it's brought together people from Marywood, Keystone, Misericordia. Gene Adams' studio accesses it. It's just brought a whole community up there. And we get together like 3 times a year. We fire the kiln, so it's fun.
Is there some sense that you're partnering with the fire?
I think there's a sense of trying to understand fire, because there is a scientific process behind firing, why the fire does what it does, how much air, the mixture, why is it bogging down, why are we not reaching temperature, you know, and all of these. And when the kiln hits a rhythm, you know, and that team that you're working with is in a rhythm, it's beautiful to watch, because it just rises nice and naturally and everyone is kind of in sync and doing what they need to do. And that's usually, it's interesting when you see shift changes, the kiln always will react a little bit. Maybe it'll drop, maybe it'll spike, because that momentary where the two systems are changing, you know, then the next shift gets its rhythm going and the kiln continues. But it's fascinating.
And it must be very aesthetically pleasing overnight when you're in the dark and...
Oh, that's why I do the overnight. You know, yeah, 5 o'clock in the morning when the sun is just cracking up over the lake and the fires are, and the flames are coming out of the stack, that's like the best. You hear the coyotes howling in the background. I tell everyone that's the best shift, because it's also the hottest shift too. You know, the kiln by 3 in the morning, the kiln's probably around 2,000 degrees and it's quite hot to work next to.
You have been doing this long enough and you are a professional, so you can be expecting what you'll find when your pieces come out, but is there always some element of surprise?
In the wood kiln? Absolutely. You know, because you load the kiln with certain expectations, with certain understanding of how the flame is moving through the chamber, but it's not a guarantee. So some spots might have gotten cold, you might have choked that area off, so that glaze looks a little different than the front glaze. There's more ash in the front than there tends to be in the back of the kiln. So every time we open the kiln, it's like Christmas morning. Yeah. And then when you get something that's, you just want to get back in and make it and put it back in the kiln, let's fire again. You know, so it's always that energy just keeps driving forward.
The show that you have and the pieces that we're going to see are very sculptural.
Yeah, these pieces are my sculpture work. I do both. I'm a functional potter, and then when I get a conceptual idea, I switch over to sculpture and work on that for a while. These pieces I've probably been working on for the last 3 years, and this is what intrigued me about when they asked me if I wanted to do this show, was that it's the first time that all of these pieces have been in one place at one time. They've been in Ohio, they've been in Pittsburgh, you know, but this is the first time I'd be able to bring the pieces together and look at them as a grouping. So that was important to me.
And the impulse, you say when you get a conceptual idea, you'll do something sculptural. Is there an underlying vision to the pieces?
Generally, yeah, I work in series. I think most artists do. And every series has a underlying concept. This kind of started about 2 years ago when my dad passed away. And we were left with my mom with dementia, Alzheimer's. So a lot of what the first piece that I did, I think it was Load, kind of came out of that understanding of what does that mean to have this all of a sudden placed on not only mine, but my sister's shoulders, you know, because we're kind of the only ones left, and now she's our responsibility, and the patriarch is gone out of the family, and there's, you know, so that was a lot to take on. And so I think a lot of artists do that. We kind of work through those things. And I look at the block pieces as the kind of the brutal approach to that concept, you know, one's load, one's burden, one's block. These are the very visceral dealings with, well, how do I deal with this burden? You know, I'm trying to run a career. I'm trying to raise my kid. I'm trying to raise my family. Now, all of a sudden, out of the blue, boom, here comes this other person that, and I think most caretakers end up having to go. There's a lot of that they have to go through. And you do come to terms with it on some level. The glyph pieces that I call the glyph pieces started out as a investigation into language, or at least that's kind of what I thought about, you know, looking at the Mayan glyphs is where kind of it started, and how do we start communicating. But as I started showing those and people started coming up to me going, what does it say? How come I can't understand it? I started to wonder whether subconsciously, looking at how my mom perceives things, Alzheimer's isn't just a memory issue. It's a perception issue as well. They don't perceive things the same way that we do. They know their words, but they can't put them together or make sense out of them. So when I started to realize that, the glyph pieces took on this whole nother conceptual meaning for me, like, wow, this is one way for people to kind of take that one little moment and go, this must be how it's like. Because I know my brain wants to tell me their words, but I don't know the meaning. You know, and that still intrigues me. I probably, and will still continue to work on the glyph pieces, because that concept of not quite understanding what you're looking at, but yet having your brain tell you it needs to make sense of something, is really fascinating to me.
And that disjunction then is very unbalancing to us.
Yeah, because your brain tells you there's shapes in there that I know I've seen before. They sort of look familiar to me because they replicate letters. So my brain wants to put them together as letters, but really, they're never going to say anything. You know, they just look like communication.
Going back to your origins as a graphic artist, mm-hmm. you might have done some exploring like that.
Yeah, I think graphic design is through all my work. I don't think I could ever say that it's separate from my clay work. I think if you look at the glyphs, they could be two-dimensional graphic design pieces. The way I handle the ferns on even on my pottery is a very graphic way of illustrating decoration on the side of pottery. So I don't think I've ever left that.
You're able to be rooted in, like, the clay centered, but in all different forms and all different ways.
Right. And I think most artists, I don't like to speak for artists, but myself, I think it is a lifelong journey. I don't think you ever, I mean, you may skip mediums, you may jump from metal to clay to back to painting and over a 20, 30, 40, 50 year lifespan, but I don't think one is ever isolated from the other. I think you're always, it's part of your life. You know, art isn't a vocation, it's a life. And I think people have a hard time understanding that.
And how do you get that across to your students when they're so fresh and innocent?
My approach is, I want them to make anything that interests them. They'll get there eventually. It's not something we're going to get to in a six-week course or even in a semester course. But if you plant the seed, hopefully they carry it through. And whether they are artists or not artists, because I don't teach a lot of artists, especially at Misericordia, they're healthcare majors, business majors. But I think if you introduce them to those concepts of what art is, hopefully that even carries through their business and how they approach healthcare and how they approach, you know, I think a lot of the things that we deal with in art go through all the other disciplines that they would have.
And you spoke about finishing up in school at that juncture when the computerized graphic design mm-hmm. world became a reality. And we are living so much on devices and before screens. I would think it's really very important for 21st century people to do something like pottery, to have our hands in the earth.
Absolutely. I think the crafts are even more important now. I mean, I think if you can expose people to fibers, knitting, weaving, clay, woodworking, metalworking, I think it roots us in a much different way than this disjointed life we lead. Everything is virtual. Our bank accounts are virtual. You know, our experiences are virtual. We get everything through this medium, and very little do we get a chance to put our hands on things. You know, that's why one of the reasons I think Misericordia restarted their studio classes is because they really, I think, recognize the need for students to put their hands on something and be creative as something else other than sitting in there and reading and cramming. And so it's a little bit of stress release, and they're always filled, so the students must feel they need it.
And when you are at the wheel, your whole body is...
Yeah, yes. It is a mind and body, full body experience. And if you're on a kick wheel, it's even more so because you become part of what drives the wheel. And then there's a different rhythm in that method of throwing. But even on an electric wheel, you know, there's a rhythm to how you work. And yes, your whole body is there over the wheel. You're locked in so you can control the clay. If you're not, then the clay throws you around. So it's important to have a body awareness. And I think that's another aspect of it that helps people out. They put you in touch with not only the material, but with where you are with the material and in actively doing something.
What did it feel like then to have all that work in one place, as you suggest?
It was great. I mean, it was the ability to kind of look at this body of work instead of just seeing it one piece at this place or stored in my garage and broken down, because all of them break down. I can't move these things as whole, so they all break down. But in that particular space too, that's a beautiful studio. That round room they have at the Wyoming Valley Art League is gorgeous. And with the dark concrete floor, these palette and clay boxes, it looks industrial. It's really a nice space to see it in. And it's just nice to finally, in some ways it's closure for me, because, you know, I can say, okay, this is what 3 years of exploring this concept has been. Here it is. I can take it in now. Hopefully everyone else can take it in now.
And how tall are some? I mean, by the time they're assembled.
The one burden is 8 feet by about 7 feet high. And it's got a steel plate, which was interesting trying to get into the gallery. But the three of us, my son and Robert and I, we were able to heft it up the stairs and we got it. Actually, it was easier than I was anticipating.
So we're talking a large scale.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. My sculptural pieces, I really try to do a lot of them off pedestal. I really like pieces that exist in real space, in real time, so people can experience them in that space, as opposed to that idea of, here's a piece of artwork on a pedestal, I can't interact with it, I can't touch it. I really like people being able to get up into the piece and walk around the piece and it become part of their experience.
What kinds of things do you like to do when you have an artist's talk?
I think I just, for this particular one, just explain the work and talk about a little bit about the process of the work, because it's just not, it's slip cast, the chains are made out of clay, how do I do that, how did I come upon, it's multimedia, there's palettes and there's wood and there's steel, and so just that whole process of how do these pieces come together from having this idea in your head to working it out, to hear these things are on the floor, and then probably have a discussion about the concept behind them. You know, what are other people's experiences with dealing with dementia and Alzheimer's? For me, the concept behind this, I think, is something that isn't talked enough about. I think, and I come in contact with a lot of people, you'll start to have a conversation, they're like, oh, my mom's going through this now. My grandmother's going through this now. I read somewhere that in a short amount of time, it'll surpass heart disease and cancer and wind up being close to a $3 billion problem for the healthcare industry. And a lot's being done. I mean, there are some really promising things out there. I mean, unfortunately for my mom, they're not going to happen. But it's just this understanding that as a caregiver, to watch your loved ones do that, it's a devastating disease, really devastating. For everybody, you know, not just the person going through, but for the family members that have to watch it. And I just hope that more people just start talking about it and encouraging more funding to go into research, because that's really, I mean, they're real close. I think there's a lot of therapies out there that are real close to finding it. But again, the funds need to be there. So hopefully we can have that conversation on Wednesday.
ceramic artist Skip Sensbach, who works in both functional and sculptural ways with clay. He teaches ceramics, and he is artist in residence at Misericordia University in Dallas, just outside Wilkes-Barre. He will offer a gallery talk tomorrow evening at 6:30. That's Wednesday, February 22nd, at the Wyoming Valley Art League in Wilkes-Barre, downtown Wilkes-Barre, where his exhibition, Mental Blocks, featuring pieces from his Glyphs series, will run now through March 30th. And that's at the Circle Center for the Arts, 130 South Franklin Street in downtown Wilkes-Barre. The talk is free and open to the public. And it's the exhibition Mental Blocks, running now through March 30th at the Wyoming Valley Art League, the Circle Center for the Arts, 130 South Franklin Street in Wilkes-Barre. And if you're interested in studying with Skip, Misericordia University has community classes, and that's misericordia.edu. But if you can, you are invited to Skip Sensbach's Artist Gallery Talk tomorrow evening at 6:30 at the Wyoming Valley Art League, Circle Center for the Arts, 130 South Franklin Street in downtown Wilkes-Barre.